concepts and also of concepts that are opposite those under consideration. Parents can assist the child in mapping important concepts and maintaining that atlas of key concepts throughout the school year. Both parents and teachers need to ascertain that a child knows what a concept is. After all, how can you think conceptually if you've never thought conceptually about a concept? Now let's turn to problem-solving thinking. Over the years, I have known lots of students who seem to lack systematic ways of solving problems. Often they are referred to our center because they are said to be impulsive, only capable of doing the first thing that comes to mind rather than thinking in a logical, sequential fashion when confronting a challenge. I have come to realize that this is a specific kind of deficit that plagues some children and most often goes undetected and untreated. Unfortunately, many of those kids get thrown by clinicians into the vast ADD heap and never receive the highly specific assistance they desperately need to emerge as problem solvers in a world that has no shortage of problems for individuals to solve. Affected children can't even problem solve well when they are concentrating, although many of them become impulsive and look as if they have attention deficits because they can't seem to access this higher thinking process. Problem solving is not an ability you can measure with confidence on an IQ or end of grade achievement test, yet it may be so much more relevant in life than a standardized score in spelling accuracy or an intelligence test component that requires a child to repeat numbers in the correct order. Effective problem solving is a systematic, logical, well-paced and planned, step-by-step process. It is the direct opposite of doing the first thing that comes to mind. Instead, it represents excellent judgment, well-founded decision-making, and the use of logical thought processes. In school and in everyday life, we can be sharing and modeling meticulous problem-solving in nurturing the developing minds of kids. I think parents and schools should be preparing students for those many critical moments in life when they will need to shift into a sophisticated and systematic problem-solving mode. To understand how problem-solving thinking operates when it's operating the way it should, we need to examine 10 steps that readily fall into place for many children. Step 1. Knowing a problem's a problem when you meet one. If your child is a good problem solver, he has a broad sense of the word problem, one that incorporates any reasonably important decision-making activity or output demand. Resolving a conflict with your friend, deciding on a topic for your science essay, preparing for a driving test, figuring out what to include in your book report on Little Women, repairing your bicycle, and combating a software glitch are all instances where an internal voice is supposed to pop up and say, "This is a problem. I need to slow down and think it through." As a parent, it can be instructive for you to note whether your child merely glosses over problems or is capable of thoughtful hesitation. Step 2. Previewing the outcome. To solve a problem, it helps to look ahead and preview or estimate the outcome of the problem-solving act. I mentioned this in the chapter on attention control, where previewing was noted to be one essential component of production or output. Previewing is also important to problem-solving. In mathematics problem solving, preview provides an estimate of the answer. In everyday life, it might conjure up a lucid vision of a desired result. In negotiating a treaty between two battling nations, a mediator might preview the outcome that when the problems are solved, the countries will live in peace, respect each other's borders, engage in commerce, and exchange cultural resources. It's hard to solve a problem without a fairly clear sense of what the solution will look like. Step 3. Assessing the feasibility. You may find your child seems to come apart at the seams when trying to estimate how difficult a task is going to be. Daily challenges either look like too much of a cinch, or else they seem forever out of reach. In assessing feasibility, a proficient problem solver undergoes a bit of a reality check. Can I solve this problem? Do I need outside help to do so? If so, from whom or from where? How long will it take? How difficult will this be? Teachers, take note. This can be gist for a worthwhile class discussion before students tackle long-term projects, say in social studies or science. Feasibility also entails looking at the costs and the benefits of solving the problem. Is it worth the effort? What will happen if I try to solve it? Why not just forget it? Should I go to the trouble of writing this book report? What will happen if I don't write it? What if I write it and get a bad grade? Is that better than not writing it at all? Such cost-benefit analyses are an integral part of problem-solving, although they can also justify some outlandish rationalizations for inaction or apathy. Step 4. Mobilizing resources. How resourceful is your child? Does he know what he needs to get a job done? In helping your child complete a complicated assignment or in collaborating on a home-based venture, such as planning a trip, parents can work through and talk through what will be required in order to accomplish specific aims. Making lists can help. Additionally, this step involves pulling together whatever it takes to get at the problem and its answer. That could entail the child soliciting help from mom, use of the internet, a review of class notes, and a search of her own personal experience. The latter involves recognition memory, namely, have I seen this kind of problem in the past? And if so, what have I done that's worked well? Step 5, thinking logically. As a parent or teacher, you would like to think that a child is reasonably rational, at least much of the time. That is, she or he makes use of logical thinking during problem solving. So it is unreasonable to separate reasoning from problem solving. They pursue the same missions. Good reasoning or logical thinking permits a problem solver to think in neat propositions, such as if I do this, then, or if it is true that, then it must be the case that I can. Logical thinking also includes using analogies to solve problems. Mango juice is a liquid like water, and if you put water in a freezer, it turns to ice. So I can make mango popsicles by freezing mango juice. Both teachers and parents should question and prompt a child's use of logic. Such cognitive coercion can make for rich dinner table and car talk. Namely, how did you come to that conclusion? Can you think of any good analogies that would help explain what you did or how you solved that problem? Step 6. Considering different strategies and picking the best one. Your kids need to learn to think strategically. This is the stage of problem solving during which an individual reviews possible methods that could facilitate the process. Good problem solvers think in options. They consider more than one approach. Example, let's see, I could learn these words by making flashcards, or I could try using each one in a sentence, or I can practice them with Emily, or I might make a semantic map of each one. Let's see, I think I'll use flashcards this time. That worked real well on the last quiz. Step 7, starting and pacing. This is where time management merges with problem solving. A proficient problem solver has a sense of time and timing, sensing when and how to get going, knowing when the process is speeding up excessively, or when it is getting bogged down, it needs to be moved along. Step 8. Self-monitoring. As your child's problem-solving gears grind away, he's supposed to keep an eye on what they're doing. Am I getting anywhere with this? Am I on the right track? How is it coming along? Such quality control inspections help with pacing and with the ongoing surveillance of the chosen strategies. Self-monitoring also comes up as a final check on a problem's solution. Is this the right or best answer? Does my answer make sense? Have I done a good enough job with this? Self-monitoring allows for self-regulation and what is sometimes called self-writing. I have dealt with an awful lot of students who barely seem aware of how they're doing or how they've done. Their dismal report cards come as a total surprise to them. Also, they are apt to turn in shoddy work without checking it over and making even the most basic, non-time-consuming corrections. Kids have to be encouraged to lean back amid problem-solving tasks and say to themselves, okay, now it's time for some of that quality control stuff. First-rate problem solvers exercise this option. Parents and teachers can prompt self-monitoring by asking, how do you think you could make this better? Step 9, dealing with impasses. This step entails knowing how to respond when problem-solving encounters an obstacle, as it often does. Or it may happen that the selected strategy has stopped working. That impasse may require the resilient problem solver to go back and make use of an alternative or backup strategy. Is your child that flexible? Or does he give up or retreat when he meets with frustration? I think parents and teachers need to serve as impasse consultants. Let me know if you have a problem with this. That's what I'm here for. Call me if you get stuck. I'll never criticize you for asking for help. We want to be sure we don't create kids who are quitters when the going gets tough. Step 10, arriving at the solution. The problem has been solved, although in the case of some problems, it can be hard to know when you've finished, when you have the right or final answer. Hopefully a student can do better than a well-known abstract painter who, when asked how he knows when he's finished with the work, responded, I can tell I'm finished when I'm sick of it. I've met more than a few students who might echo these sentiments, as a result of which they tend to finish when they're really not finished. Once a problem has been solved, your triumphant child should think back over the process, largely to determine explicitly what he has learned and how it might be applied in the future. This kind of reflection is often omitted and should certainly be integrated with all teaching and learning. Teachers in particular should get into the habit of asking kids after a test or at the conclusion of a class discussion, let's think of the different times and places where this kind of problem solving can be used again to create something or to help you out of a brain jam of some sort. Now let's look at the third form of higher thinking, critical thinking. Your children probably were not born with razor-sharp critical thinking. Growing up, they require plenty of experience and direct exposure to this higher thinking process. They should hear their parents and teachers assessing the validity and quality of ideas, people, and things. Critical thinking functions represent a triumph over naivete, as they equip kids to resist deception and to become more perceptive evaluators. Non-critical thinkers accept far too much at face value. They may be more concrete and have trouble looking beneath the surface, analyzing and evaluating that which is more than what meets the eye. Others, of course, go too far and become out-and-out cynics. They detect fault wherever they look and are willing to accept nothing without questioning. Quite obviously, there are certain ages in which this kind of evaluative cynicism, often caustically conveyed through sarcasm, becomes a way of life, 8th grade more or less being the watershed, a seeming-to-know-it-all attitude in which kids are reluctant to accept what they encounter, especially when conveyed by parents. As with problem-solving, parents and teachers can walk kids through a step-by-step approach to critical thinking. Step 1. Enumerating the facts. You might say to a child, let's start out and describe the video you watched. Later on, we'll decide if it was any good. In other words, whatever it is your child is to evaluate should first be described objectively. Just report the facts. For example, in writing a book report, your daughter first recounts details of the plot if it's a novel, or summarizes the content of a nonfiction work. After all, she can't evaluate something if she hasn't focused on its important details. Step 2. Uncovering the author's or creator's point of view. A student should practice some serious detective work at this step. You can prompt your child to expose and describe any point of view, intention, or motive she can uncover in the work. For example, this ad is trying to sell Toyotas. Or I think the person who wrote this article wants us to vote for a Democratic candidate. Step 3. Establishing what the child thinks. The child asks herself, how do I feel about that? What's my opinion or point of view? As a parent or teacher, you can ask, how do you think your feelings about this are going to affect your critical thinking in this case? So a child, with you as a guide, identifies her own point of view or personal biases. Step 4. Searching for errors and exaggerations. Look for and describe any errors, distortions, false claims, or exaggerations in what is being evaluated. If you are evaluating a person, is that individual honest, the genuine item, or a phony in some respects? Included in this step is what is called appearance versus reality. Mainly, what's on the surface and what's authentic. You can practice this step with a child by jointly critiquing ads in a magazine or on TV. On the surface, the soup they're advertising appears delicious and nutritious. In reality, we once tried it and it was gross. Watery and loaded with preservatives and artificial food coloring, and it tasted like diluted cough syrup. Step 5. Getting outside help. Parents and teachers need to alert kids to the fact that you don't have to go it alone. There are lots of resources around to help you with your critical thinking. This step might include gathering other people's opinions, checking out consumer reports, or downloading relevant information from an expert website. There are many ways of combining research with critical thinking. A student might read a book or see a movie and then read one or more reviews of the work. In his critical appraisal, he might quote from a reviewer. He can even do some critical thinking about that critical thinker. Step 6. Weighing the evidence. During this step, your son or daughter or student pulls together all of the above steps to produce his own well-informed opinion. This entails separating and considering the objective findings, your own biases, the intent, motives, or point of view of the subject, and the information you have gathered from various sources. And then, through some mysterious, possibly quite subjective formula, a child develops a critical view that he can defend. Step 7. Communicating. The task is not over yet. Once an evaluation is complete, a child needs to exercise his communication skills to share his critical thinking with the outside world. This needs to be accomplished in a reasonably cohesive and convincing manner. It would be a shame if excellent points were obscured by deficient or unclear communication. Effective expressive language, therefore, dramatically enhances the end products of critical thinking. Kids with language difficulties are at a disadvantage when it comes to critical thinking. In fact, it has been shown that many of them are handicapped by a chronic inability to formulate opinions using words. And when you can't shape an opinion, you are left with biases, prejudices, and gut reactions, any or all of which can get you into trouble, which happens all the time. You don't want your child to be victimized or taken in by any person, product, or set of ideas. The procedures and habits for critical thinking can keep a kid out of trouble and intellectually sharp. Critical thinking is also a lot of fun. Kids display wide variation in their critical thinking across areas of content. Some may be astute sports analysts, junior Monday morning quarterbacks, while others are precocious literary critics and still others are master appraisers of character within the local social panorama. As with other areas of higher thinking, we should teach explicit critical thinking skills starting out in the realms toward which a child has a natural interest and then transferring these thinking skills into other areas. I saw this accomplished masterfully by a fourth grade teacher in Texas who devoted some time to teaching kids the meaning of critical thinking. Then each student was told to pick a subject or activity that he or she really enjoyed and write something critical about it, using a watered-down version of the format I spoke of earlier. While I was visiting the classroom, one child critically evaluated his latest computer game, giving it mixed reviews. Another assessed the Texas Rangers, giving them mostly positive reviews, and a 10-year-old aspiring gourmet put forth an informed opinion regarding the cuisine in her school's lunchroom, highly negative. The kids were having a terrific time while exercising and incorporating a vital higher order thinking capacity. The fourth form of higher thinking is rule-guided thinking. School is saturated with rules. There are rules wherever you look. They govern behavior or decorum in the corridor, the boys' room, and the lunchroom. Tightly regulated procedures cover obtaining permission to urinate, as well as the proper certification when you need to depart early or arrive late due to a dental appointment. Violations such as gum chewing lead to punitive action. There is also a collection of formal academic rules, which include spelling rules, phonetic rules, scientific rules, and mathematical rules, sometimes called formulas. Rules generally take the form of if-then, such as if this is the beginning of a sentence, then there needs to be a capital letter. Or if you are adding fractions, do so with the numerator, not the denominator, if the denominators are the same. Or if you use the word although in a sentence, then the two clauses have to contradict each other. The ubiquitous if-thens infiltrate all subject areas, and some kids are more able than others to cope with the rules they need to learn and can even think up some handy rules of their own. As a parent, you may find that your child has his greatest difficulty in subjects that contain and depend the most on rules. Studying grammar, learning a foreign language, and succeeding in mathematics and physics may be thwarted as a result. Children who are having trouble using rules to guide their thinking should maintain a rule book in school. They should receive specific coaching in the interpretation and use of rules. They need to recite rules, translate them into their own words, and offer examples of the rules at work, as well as examples of exceptions to the rules. One reason for having your child understand and make liberal use of rules is that they enable kids to deal smoothly with situations that occur predictably on a regular basis, such as the need to punctuate a sentence. But in addition to fostering a strong sense of regularity, rules also set the stage for recognizing irregularity, for noticing the exceptions to rules. If you don't have a profound grasp of rules, you may be insensitive to the irregularities that erupt within any body of subject matter or skill. Thus, by understanding spelling rules, a student often can predict the spelling of a new word, and this can sensitize a kid to words that are illegal, that is, irregular words that violate those venerable spelling rules. The English language has more than its share of those notorious violators. Now let's look at the final form of higher thinking, creative thinking. Every child has within him a creative voice crying out for discovery. In some girls and boys, the cry is quite loud. In others, it's a soft murmur. Parents and teachers need to remain watchful for little creative sparks awaiting ignition. Creative opportunities liberate a child's mind to cross into personal zones of higher thinking. In being creative, kids unshackle their minds and discover novel possibilities for self-expression and mental free play. Sadly, kids differ in the opportunities they are given to become creative thinkers and doers. But when given the chance, most kids can discover and enjoy a personal channel for original thinking. Highly creative kids and adults share some basic neurodevelopmental qualities. In my own work with children who have learning problems, I have been struck repeatedly by how many struggling students display creative tendencies as they engage in imaginative ventures. Creative thinking boils down to an amalgam of behaviors and traits that promote originality. I'll detail some of these behaviors now, a number of which I gleaned from Dr. Howard Gardner's superb and highly creative book, Creating Minds. Divergent thinking. A willingness and ability to free associate, to emancipate your mind and go off on interesting and original tangents, often not knowing where exactly you're likely to end up. Divergent thinking is the opposite of convergent thinking. In the latter, thoughts are highly specific and directed at finding a narrowly defined fact or solution to a problem. Top-down processing. a willingness to sprinkle liberally your own personal associations, values, and perspectives over much of what you come across. Top-down processing makes you highly subjective in reacting to information and experience. For example, some students are described as top-down readers. When they read a short story, they relate it to people, places, and experiences in their own personal lives. They often impose over their reading their own unique and characteristically personalized interpretations and ideas, even though this may not be what the author had in mind. They dislike having to stick to the facts as provided in an article or textbook. When given an assignment, a top-down student is likely to try to improve upon it, somehow modifying the expectations to allow her creative machinery to operate without restriction. Some teachers encourage this form of thinking, others punish or even ban it. Risk-taking. A willingness to risk being wrong. To risk creating something others will denigrate, mock, or otherwise react to disapprovingly. Creative kids and adults have to resign themselves to being controversial. They may even come to enjoy that status. My own boss at Harvard Medical School once warned me at the start of my career, "Mel, if you're not controversial, it means you're not being very creative." I guess that means I'm creative. Autonomy from peer pressures and standards. A willingness to think and produce in a manner that runs the risk of deviating from accepted norms among your own peer group. A highly creative person is likely to be unwilling to alter his work substantially just to please his audience or his colleagues. I have seen too many teenagers whose creativity is stifled because they are so anxious to please their friends. I remember one boy who at age 11 was writing original solo music for the viola. He had a passion for the instrument. Then in eighth grade, hormonal geysers erupted, and other kids became all important in his life. On multiple occasions, he was accused of being a dork for playing the viola. He stopped taking viola lessons and ceased to compose his own sonatas. He opted for being cool rather than creative. There's enormous pressure on kids to make this awful choice. Discovery and pursuit of the right medium. A willingness to search and come up with a channel for one's creative drives. That may be sculpture, dance, musical composition, comedy, or any number of other possible pathways. Parents and teachers have an obligation to chaperone kids on such creative opportunity shopping expeditions through their school years. Stylistic distinctiveness. A willingness to be unusual, to develop a unique voice, niche, or personal style, and then imbue this distinctiveness within your work. Your child can begin to do this during his school years. Great artists become distinctive rather than imitative. That's how we recognize that a painting is a Picasso, even though we've never before viewed that particular canvas. A person may be creative at making unusual satirical steel sculptures of animals, or finding a niche as a composer of modern-day madrigals. These traits, which are only a sampling of many, seldom represent conscious policy decisions on the part of creators. Rather, they are most often unconscious behaviors, even during childhood. There are kids who are spontaneously creative. They do all or most of the above without any adult coercion. At home and in school, it's helpful to foster a climate and the right opportunities so that creative tendencies are stimulated and cultivated over time. Our social thinking system. There's a new kid on the block. Kevin would like to make friends with him, so he offers to show him where the lunchroom is and asks if he'd like to sit with him during lunch today. Ralph and his friend Hackett disagree about what to do tonight. Ralph wants to go to a movie, and Hackett wants to play computer games. Ralph cleverly suggests they rent a video and play computer games for a little while instead of all evening. In both of these instances, students are exercising their social strengths. Kevin has demonstrated his ability to set up a new relationship, while Ralph knows how to resolve incipient social conflict without having to resort to aggression. Social initiation and conflict resolution are both examples of neurodevelopmental functions that play a significant role in relationships among kids. The strength or weakness of these and other functions that comprise social ability help determine whether your child's life at school and in the neighborhood will be fulfilling or traumatic. Many kids who have more than their share of trouble with learning also suffer social wounds at school. I get to see and try to help many such students at the Center for Development and Learning in Chapel Hill. Sometimes I'm asked to consult regarding a kid who gets very good grades but has no friends. I invariably discover underlying defects in specific social functions. Doug was a prime example, a boy accustomed to being unpopular. Doug's parents brought him to see me to get help with his interpersonal misery. They drove in from Washington, where Doug was a student at a prominent, high-powered independent school known for educating the children of our national leaders, ostensibly super kids with great kinds of minds. Mostly, his mother and father wanted me to demystify this boy, to help him gain insight into his specific social shortcomings. Hopefully, a big dose of personal insight would inspire Doug to work on building his social abilities. Doug was small for an 11-year-old. He also was conspicuously chubby, with a nearly spherical face. Because an unfair amount of his weight was misallocated to his chest, he appeared to have unusual breast development, which wasn't the case. But this anatomical dirty trick of fate was readily observed and a favorite topic of his peers, especially during physical education. Nothing hurt Doug more than all those cruel comments about his body. The other kids had never taken to Doug. They called him names, bullied him, and walled him off like an infected abscess. At the bus stop, a favorite pastime was known as "Let's bug Doug the bug." Sometimes when teased, Doug would become incensed and explode into cursing and fighting. Some of the other kids found his inflammatory reactions hilariously entertaining and actually derived gleeful exhilaration in detonating him. Doug's parents were justifiably proud of his wide-ranging talents and interests. He was enthusiastic about science fiction, video games, and computers. He harbored a passion for collecting rocks and comic books. In fact, he loved buying comic books almost more than anything else. He would read his collection over and over again and had become an expert on all comic book characters. Other kids considered Doug's interests totally, unacceptably weird. Many of them talked about clothes and music. Doug was not the least bit interested in what kind of clothes he wore, in how he looked, in buying CDs in the mall, or talking about sports. Doug's sister Becky, who was very popular, wanted Doug to act more cool and less like a dork. Doug, however, didn't understand what she meant. To add to his predicament, Doug had a penchant for saying the wrong things, at least from a social ingratiation standpoint. Well, he would express things at the wrong times. When other kids were dead serious, Doug would crack a joke. When peers were having a ball, Doug would say something gravely serious or sad. He was out of step. He could never match moods with others. When Doug got going on a topic that interested him, he never knew when or how to put the brakes on his monologue. Also, when Doug said or did something that made others think he was strange, he had no insight into what they were thinking. Yet Doug liked himself the way he was. Doug's guidance counselor had explained to him that he lacked social skills. A school psychologist told his parents that Doug must have Asperger syndrome, a mild form of autism. The parents rejected this notion, insisting that having weak social skills shouldn't be thought of as a disease any more than being a poor ping-pong player or having trouble carrying a tune should be incorporated into some stigmatizing syndrome. Many people are using the designation Asperger syndrome for kids like Doug, but I had to agree with Doug's parents. I have seen no convincing scientific evidence that it exists as a discrete disorder of some kind, like a strep throat. I worry when we try to make every little cluster of traits into a syndrome, ignoring the toxic, stigmatizing effects of being so designated, which can last a lifetime. We could help Doug without forcing him to become a pathological specimen. After isolating his specific social gaps, I spent a lot of time talking to Doug, demystifying him. After an extended discussion of his many strengths, we made a list of Doug's particular social weaknesses. I taught him the names of the functions he needed to work on. After all, how can you work on something if you don't even know what it's called? We discussed ways he could practice such things as picking the right topics to talk about at the right times with other kids, and how to gauge their moods so you don't seriously conflict with them. Initially, Doug denied he had any social problems, which is common. Soon, however, his defenses seemed to dissolve, and he became riveted on our discussion. Over the ensuing months, Doug got some targeted advice on these issues from a school counselor. Also, the headmaster of his school cracked down on verbal and physical abuse among kids. His parents had social coaching sessions with Doug a couple of nights a week at bedtime. They came back to see me a few times in North Carolina, and I was impressed by Doug's newly assimilated understanding and willingness to acknowledge and work on what he called my social trouble. Most students will tell you that social pressure exceeds academic pressure by a long shot. Some of them are up to it. They happen to be socially well endowed, equipped to handle the social tests their peers administer. They know how to play the popularity games, and they play them for all they're worth. Social gratification and acceptance are the trophies. Protection from humiliation and a strong sense of belonging represent additional dividends. For others, the social part of school is a source of anguish. In fact, chronic rejection by one's peers is one of childhood's saddest stories. A multitude of factors contributes to the social success or failure of a school-age child. Physical appearance, self-confidence, and credible social role models all exert their influence. But most important are a student's own social capacities. Obviously, social functioning varies dramatically from kid to kid. By understanding the specific dysfunctions that can be seen in a socially unsuccessful person, we can help him or her put the pieces together and derive some social satisfaction at long last. The social challenges children face can be separated into three daily missions. The friendship mission. Your child's friends are unquestionably among her or his most coveted possessions. Friends are so much fun, so reinforcing, so supportive, and so protective. Friendship formation and maintenance is our first social mission. Having a friend demands that your child relate successfully on an individual basis. This is relatively independent of overall reputation among your peers, that is to say, popularity. Rather, friendship involves starting and keeping up a succession of mutually rewarding experiences with another individual. Of course, it is common to form any number of such working bonds, culminating in a nice collection of stable and positive relationships. The popularity mission. Your children may want popularity more than anything else in the whole world. That drive constitutes the second engaging social mission. It differs from friendship in that popularity consists of having a positive reputation among a larger circle of peers. It is possible for your offspring to be popular without having any strong friendships. It is just as possible to have some very solid friendships and not be notably popular. The political mission. It may seem a bit disconcerting to ponder, but childhood is political. Kids have to learn to interact advantageously with individuals in a position to help or hurt them. They need to figure out and influence those who are influential. They do so by forming constructive bonds with such individuals. Their political moves are seldom calculated maneuvers. They are more likely to be unconscious, to seem like the right thing to do or say. Probably the earliest political lessons are learned through sibling rivalries, power struggles within a family that play out as kids seek preferred or privileged treatment from their parents. The social thinking system consists of a repertoire of partly overlapping neurodevelopmental functions that equip kids to become socially acceptable, indulge in durable relationships, and make the grade politically in and out of school. I think it's helpful to divide the social thinking system into social language functions and social behaviors. That's because I've encountered students who have trouble with the verbal parts of interactions, but not the behavioral, and vice versa. I think as a parent observing the social side of your child's existence, you are in a position to take note of both how well he communicates with other people and how effectively he acts with them. Students who are popular and who form sound friendships are strong in most or all of the key social functions. Social language function. Every time Chris opens his mouth, he succeeds in alienating all those within 25 feet of him. He sounds abrasive, antagonistic, and boastful without realizing it. Over his decade-long life, he has managed to turn off gaggles of his peers. He has no inkling that the way he talks is the reason for his consistent rejection by classmates. Then there's 17-year-old Lola, who can't seem to carry on a conversation with anyone. With her, there's never any verbal give and take. It's as if she's forever delivering monologues or solo arias with no recognition or response to any points or ideas brought up by anyone else. Other teens have begun to avoid Lola. She is devastated over the fact that she was recently snubbed and not invited to the graduation party of one of her best friends. Chris and Lola both are inadvertently navigating toward social exclusion through their social language, or rather their lack thereof. Social language functions differ from literate language functions described earlier. So your child may be as smooth as cashmere with social language, but downright coarse when it comes to the linguistics of formal learning. In many respects, social language comprises the highest, the most complex language mode. The study of patients with serious head trauma has provided some evidence for this view. Individuals who have been in calamitous motor vehicle accidents often go through a period in which many of their language functions become seriously compromised. A year later, most of them have recovered the major part of their pre-accident language capabilities. But most have not gotten back, and often never regain, their social language functions. Acquaintances comment, "No one's been able to get along with him since his car crash." We often witness the progressive erosion of social language functions in the elderly. Hence, we apply the term old grouch or old codger to characterize the abrasive, abrupt, negative vernacular of many older individuals. They're not as unpleasant as they sound. Some of their social language sheen has simply worn off with age. A vital social resource for your child is the ability to express accurate feelings through language, those feelings she or he would like to convey or should convey. Many individuals with social language dysfunctions are forever being misinterpreted because they, like Chris mentioned earlier, have trouble regulating their tone of voice, choice of words, and rhythm of language to convey their feelings accurately. As a result, they sound angry when they're not. Parents need to be alert for this common variety of social dysfunction, which can start to manifest itself as early as age 5 or 6. Affected kids need constant feedback from their parents, and they should be given more socially acceptable ways of saying things. Weak social language abilities also may interfere with interpreting the feelings of others when they speak. A kid with social language dysfunction may have trouble telling when you are joking or when you're serious. He may infer from your speech that you're angry with him when actually you're not. Parents can help with this too. During or after watching a movie, they can talk about the characters and ask a child to identify the different feelings expressed by each. Such discussions of things people say that reveal how they feel need to be a recurring theme for some kids. Code switching is another social language function. Code switching means simply that you don't talk in the same manner with everyone. Your child is expected to talk differently to his parents from how he speaks to his little sister, from how he converses with the cat, from how he communicates with his best friend, from how he verbalizes ideas to his math teacher, from how he expresses himself to a policeman. Other critical social language signposts to watch for in your children include regulation of humor, Children need to know when and how to joke around depending upon current circumstances and the people they're with. Requesting skills. Knowing how to ask for things without alienating everyone. Mood matching. Being able to match feelings with those of others so you show some sadness when they're telling you something sad. Complimenting. The ability and willingness to say something that makes another person feel good. And lingo fluency. The ability to use the terminology and speech mannerisms of the contemporary culture. Good social language means effective communication. And effective communication goes a long way toward forming meaningful and uplifting relationships with others. So we should help kids think about the impact of their words upon others. Social behaviors. Dressing appropriately for an occasion, making good eye contact when meeting someone for the first time, showing sympathy when someone informs you his dog was hit by a car, and collaborating smoothly with other members of the refreshments committee are samples of competent social behavior. Social capacity takes in a collection of such actions or behaviors that speak louder than words. There are many facets of social behavior. Here we will consider a small group of especially important ones. Conflict resolution, the interpretation of feedback, marketing oneself to others, collaborating with peers, and making use of social information. Resolving serious conflict without resorting to aggression is a real social accomplishment. Many students with social cognitive gaps have no idea how to deal with the setbacks, the impasses, and the interpersonal glitches of day-to-day human interactions. There is no such thing as a social relationship immune from conflict. The real issue is how well people patch up the differences and repair dented egos. When children can't seem to resolve conflict and instead display outbursts of violence or tears, parents need to work with them to keep reviewing alternative actions that they might have tried. Discussions of conflicts should take the emphasis off who started it or who was the culprit, and instead stress what might be tried the next time such a negative scene takes place. We need to teach kids the art of no-fault conflict resolution. It's a great asset to take with you through life. In relating to one another, kids constantly have to absorb and interpret social feedback. They need to pick up the sometimes subtle cues etched on the facial expressions or body movements of those with whom they are interacting. If a boy lets loose with a hostile shove or slap, something that really bothers or pains his neighbor, that perpetrator ought to arrive at the instant realization that he said or did something hostile. After an accurate reading of social feedback cues, painted in living color on his friend's face, he can self-correct and recover. For example, by saying, "I was only kidding, I didn't really mean to do that." Of course, if you are insensitive when it comes to social feedback, as is the case for many kids with social cognitive dysfunctions, you don't even notice that you are infuriating the person you are with. You keep on rubbing salt in the wound, sinking deeper and deeper into social jeopardy with that individual. Not surprisingly, many kids with weak attention controls have difficulty with self-monitoring. They fail to notice their social faux pas just as dependably as they make unnoticed, careless errors in their academic work. In other words, they don't watch what they're doing. A toolkit of social thinking behaviors enables a kid to market himself to others. He is able to create a demand for his presence. First, there is an awareness of the image he is broadcasting to others. He can sense how he is coming across. The way he dresses, the way he acts, and the tastes he manifests create deep impressions. How acutely aware is he of how he's perceived by others? To what extent is he able to shape and project the self-image that others are attracted to and respect? The answers to these questions have a strong bearing on social acceptance. Some kids have no notion of how to assemble their image. Consequently, they fail miserably at marketing themselves to their peers. There can be many reasons for this, some subtle and some obvious. Strange as it may seem, there are those who have some trouble producing socially acceptable body movements. They move awkwardly, or they invade other people's space. Their movements somehow repel their classmates, and sometimes adults, too. This has actually been characterized as a neurological condition called dysesthesia, a state in which individuals lack control over the ways they navigate their bodies through space. As a result, they come across as clumsy, awkward, or unappealing. In addition to invading other people's space too readily, kids with dysesthesia have problems using hand gestures appropriately. For example, the movements of their hands may contradict what they are saying. One child I knew was observed pounding on the table while telling a joke. The regulation of facial expressions can also be an issue. The same child who pounded on the table often looked angry or had a scowl on his face when he really wasn't intending to appear morose or hostile. Collaboration is another key ingredient of social behavior. Students vary considerably in the extent to which they are team players. Nowadays, many schools appropriately stress collaboration, since the bulk of productivity in our adult operations entails teamwork on the job. But some children have trouble assuming a collaborative role. They seek too much control, or they fail to do their share and thereby alienate others. They lack the sensors needed to make the determination of how assertive and how helpful to be in a coordinated, collaborative activity. Other kids with weak collaborative abilities have difficulty giving up any control. They feel compelled to dominate every relationship and to try to take all the credit for positive accomplishments while blaming others for setbacks. They lack a sense of fair play and have great difficulty taking the perspective of fellow collaborators, meeting some of their needs at the same time that all are working toward a joint goal. Children who lack collaboration skills shy away from team sports, committees, and other combined campaigns in school. It is also common for them to be rejected as prospective lab partners or teammates because of their reputation as soloists or unequal sharers. Many kids I've evaluated for social problems struggle to interpret social information. They can't seem to gather the myriad moment-to-moment social cues and use those data to understand what's going on so they can make appropriate responses. Before he started to make social progress, Doug's teacher reported to his mother a revealing tidbit. She picked up on the fact that whenever somebody bumped into him in the corridors, Doug had no way of determining whether it was intentional or not. In other words, Doug could not read the evidence, the multiple signs that would tell him whether or not the collider in the hallway was out to get him, or whether that fleeting body contact was just an accident. Social information processing includes reading people's true intentions, their feelings, their facial expressions. It also takes in the ability to interpret upper limb gestures, the hidden meanings in the way other people move their hands and their arms. Pretty subtle, but highly revealing. On my farm in North Carolina, I love to watch the way my swans communicate with their necks. Different positions connote anger, threat, apprehension, or sheer vanity. People are no different, but we use our limbs and facial expressions instead of our necks to transmit nonverbal social messages. Summing up, kind of looks like I was born to lose. I don't do anything right when it comes to school. I just can't wait till I grow up, when I only have to do what I'm good at. School makes me feel completely and totally worthless. All my friends catch on to stuff faster than I do. The other kids in my class are smarter than me. Here's what keeps happening. I get a little behind, but I don't feel like dealing with it, so I put it behind me. Then I get more behind, and I don't feel like bothering with it. And then I'm too far behind to do anything about it. And that's the way it happens every year. I think my parents would trade me in if they could. As these self-deflating, melancholy quotes suggest, repeated frustration has the potential to downgrade a kid's estimates of self-worth. At any distance along the academic track, your child's mind could derail. For example, a college student may discover that the heavy dose of terminology and zoology is more than she can handle, despite the fact that she was in the top 10% of her high school class. Well into adult life, a certified transmission specialist may plummet into a career tailspin when having to incorporate some brand new automobile computer technology. An effervescent 6-year-old who has consumed the early phases of kindergarten like a hot fudge sundae suddenly may develop a school phobia because he can't seem to match up sounds with the right symbols for reading words. So it is, as the demands increase and change over time, different kinds of minds are likely to prosper or founder. Most kids simply lack the insulation to handle repeated frustration and personal failure. Some simply surrender. Some become permanently anxious or depressed. Others act out, cause trouble, get themselves pregnant, or take drugs. Still others become transformed into conservative non-risk takers, shutting down and decisively writing themselves off at an early age. Or else they keep criticizing and putting down whatever it is they can't succeed at. Algebra's useless, I'm never going to use it. There's no way I'll ever need to speak Spanish. None of the frustration complications has to occur. As parents, you want to make sure they don't occur. The first preventive step involves understanding your child's neurodevelopmental profile and being able to anticipate the demands that will be made on it. The goal of this program has been to introduce you to some of the concepts that can light the way toward that kind of understanding. If any of the issues we've covered here hit home, I encourage you to follow up. The book from which this program is drawn, also titled A Mind at a Time, offers more detailed information about how to evaluate your child's learning abilities, where to find resources that can help, both at home and at school, and how teachers, parents, and students can collaborate more effectively on this most vital of all missions, the education and upbringing of our children. I encourage you also to visit our website at www.allkindsofminds.org, all kinds of minds being one long word. If your particular neurological profile doesn't retain websites readily, you can also find the web address on the program package. And I leave you for now with this final thought. This program is filled with moral and ethical implications. Our awareness of neurodevelopmental variation leads us to ask how much of a right we have to change the way somebody is wired or to stand in ruthless judgment of that wiring. We should question what we are saying when we call an individual abnormal, in view of our respect for variation and for the differences among the minds of members of a society. In truth, it is normal to be different. Recognizing this, we must make a firm social and political commitment to neurodevelopmental pluralism. We can now see how unjust it is to criticize, to obliterate the self-respect and aspirations of a child you don't understand. Imagine growing up being told you can do better, when the person glibly conveying that accusatory message happens to be wrong. It is morally unjustifiable for a child to have to suffer public condemnation for not submitting homework when transforming his ideas into words is an insurmountable barrier for him. Schools are like airport hubs. Student passengers arrive from many different backgrounds and take off for widely divergent destinations. Their particular takeoffs into adulthood will demand different flight plans. Fortified with our understanding of neurodevelopmental functions and differences, we can affirm a new mind-based humanism within a society that values, respects, and preserves all kinds of minds, beginning during early childhood and continuing through our entire lifespans. No mind should have to beg to differ.
A Mind at a Time. America's top learning expert shows how every child can succeed. Was written and read by Dr. Mel Levine. It was abridged for audio by Jesse Boggs. The recording engineer was Davis Stilson at Lloyd Studios in North Carolina. Post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Jessica Cassidy. A Mind at a Time was produced and directed by Karen Frillman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.